This is an opera cast from English National Opera. For more information and to book tickets, visit www.eno.org.
Now, I'm actually in Fiona Shaw's dressing room between performances of London Assurance, and I'm not quite sure what Lady Gay Spanker would make of that, but she'd probably rather enjoy it, I think. I suspect.
She'd love that. Yeah, she'd love the opera. I don't think she's ever been to one.
She's a glorious creation, actually, Fiona. I thought it was terrific what you did with her, because she's so warm. It could so easily be a kind of horsey comic act, couldn't it? But
absolutely,
there's great
right.
warmth to her character.
I thought, you know, a person called Lady Gay Spanker, you could be left with either one line or one joke for the whole evening. But she represents for me a kind of group of women I did know when I was growing up in Ireland, part of the North Cork Hunt. And they had warmth and a kind of eternal day that every day was great fun. And my mother's a bit like this. She's not haughty at all, but she's incredibly, just loves every day. And I think it's a relationship to time that people in the country have, that people in the city don't have. And I really wanted to celebrate that. So.
Explosive joy. Yes.
Absolutely. Real joy, yes.
Now, you're this insane schedule of rehearsing sort of very intense German expressionism in the day and kind of playing Restoration comedy at night. I mean, does it help that they're so utterly different?
Yes. I mean, it was only possible to do the opera knowing that Lady Gay Spanker was my evening work, not Mother Courage. I would be now, you know, under a grave if that was the case.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think it's an antidote. Oddly, Lady Gay Spanker is based on laughing, so it's very energising, though I am shattered by the end of the day. But doing the Henze all day is what really engages me, all day. And I found that I've just enjoyed sitting with these fantastic singers and being a meditative presence. I mean, I have to do a bit more than that, but it's like meditating on that music and hearing it all day. And actually, I think it's a release to Lady Gay Spanker, because the music is draining. It's fantastic music, but at the end of the day, you feel absolutely wiped from it.
You actually met Henze at the beginning of this process. What were your impressions? I mean, it's an extraordinary story, and how a young man emerged from Hitler Youth with his integrity intact in any way is it something little short of a miracle. But
yes, actually, I was in LA last year, and I met Tom Addis, and I had just agreed to this project, and I asked Tom to come and listen to a bit of it with me. And he said, you can hear from very early on the music is a very frightened young man in the music. And actually, I think Henze, when I met him in his gorgeous house in Italy, we had lunch together, he said, the war marked me. And I mean, that's maybe an obvious cliche for many people, but it really marked him, in that at every point he's going back to it. So I'm very respectful of that, and I know what he means. I mean, I think that he felt that his cells changed with that war, and he was only 16 or 17 when he was put in that into the army, and to have the Allied troops hearing them bombing as they came towards him while he was in the back of this terrible tank. He said it was one of the most terrifying moments. And the sergeant took pity on him and allowed him to go to the back of the tank. He just wasn't suited to that kind of expression of human culture. You know, people throwing, bombing each other. I'm with him there. And the result is that during the rehearsals of this Henze opera, which, as you know, is set in 1910, though written by Auden over maybe 1959 to 1962, is that I want to pay some homage to that century. Both those men seem to be skipping the issue of the war, but design-wise, we have slightly played with it.
Ah. Now, for the benefit of people who've never encountered this piece, Elegy for Young Lovers, we're in the Austrian Alps, in this hotel which kind of reeks of Thomas Mann and his ilk. And I gather you and your designer, Tom Pye, went on a recce to find or get an idea
of
what
these
places
were like.
We did. We
went to a place called Wendt, which is high up outside Vienna. I mean, it's quite way up at the mountains. And we went in that early springtime, which is an unusual time because you have a great thaw happening, piles of water gushing down through bits of snow, and then you also have the glacier up high, so the higher you go. Meanwhile, on the sort of lower slopes, beautiful flowers, you know, absolutely gorgeous buttercups, so just gorgeous things. So you have three layers, and it's just set in a hotel. For anyone who doesn't know the opera, you don't need to know very much. It is in English. It is written in English, originally in English. It's in poetic English, but there are many, many words, very, very many words. And it's set in a hotel with a poet and his kind of entourage, which is a doctor and a secretary, his mistress, and the doctor, his doctor's son who turns up. And then there's this lady who lives in the hotel all the time called Hilda Mack, who's there because she's waiting for her husband to come back because he went for a walk up the mountain 40 years earlier and never returned. So it's a mix. It's all about time. It's the rest of
the yeah, time. So she has these extraordinary visions, if you like. I mean, her language is very poetic. And the poet kind of feeds on her visions, doesn't he? For his poem, almost for his own creative gratification, if you like.
It's very interesting. Henser told me that they were going to make the poet an actor and make the opera about an actor. A big ego, a man who's willing to devour all around him. It's rather rude to actors, or any creative artist. And it goes oddly by doing a poet. I suppose Auden was lampooning himself or his
yes.
kind.
Yes.
But he is willing to. I mean, one only has to be near many creative artists, designers, directors, to see that they do need an enormous amount of energy, but they also give energy. And I think, actually, I hope we haven't shortchanged it by making it about any one thing, but allowing that the creative process is difficult. And this man does steal Hilda Mack's visions that she has. She just has these strange visions about mountains and death, so she has premonitions as well. But they're never direct, and he sort of takes them and shapes them into poems. But I'm not sure. I don't know many writers who don't do something like that. I know lots of writers who read astrology and who are always playing some sort of theosophic game.
It is an interesting argument, isn't it? Because, as you say, there is a selfishness in all creative people. Mm. They have to somehow shut the real world out, but also feed on it in some way.
Mm.
And it's interesting in the piece how the music develops as the poem develops. I think that's one of the most fascinating things about the composition.
I think for people who don't know the music, I think it's always hard to hear new music. Our ear is not good with the new. But the great thing about this music is much of it is references to Berg and Strauss even. I mean, there's lots and lots of references to early 20th century music. He says there's no reference to Wagner, but I can hear Wagner. Mm. There's certainly bits of Poulenc, certainly Benjamin Britten at the end of it. So there'll be lots of for those who know music, they will have fun playing with that. But more importantly, beauty is at the bottom of it. So the music's attempt is to be beautiful, even though sometimes the seven percussion instruments are playing right across all sorts of thoughts and gentleness. So it's very challenging in that way, but it's not unlistenable to. And there are duets and trios and quartets that would absolutely melt your heart.
Yes, that duet between Hilda and Elizabeth is
fantastic. Yeah.
Talking of solitude is just ravishing.
Beautiful.
But it does have that crystalline quality, the clarity
it
of it, doesn't it?
It does,
so, which
it
goes with the cold mountain air, that kind of rarefied.
And we've built a set which we're trying to allow. It's set in a hotel in the mountains. And when Tom and I were in the mountains, we did feel that the hotel was sort of overbearingly overshadowed by the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So we've tried to get that, rather than have a mountain outside the hotel, that somehow the mountain and the hotel are the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's very much the feeling, because you're so isolated up a mountain. And also somehow a mountain is halfway between heaven and hell,
mm-hmm.
or heaven and earth. And you feel that Hilda Mack is sort of almost going up towards heaven. There's a lovely man called Maurer who doesn't sing, who's the caretaker, and he's like a sort of cairn figure who's between, also like an angel between heaven and hell, or heaven and earth. And they talk about the green place, which is the sort of way, way down, the mountain. So you're in a suspended place halfway, and I think it's a very good use of metaphor, of place, to suspend this group of people who are then in a sort of...
We're in the theatre.
Yes, it was in a sort of Wheatlow, sort of almost Sartian. I mean, there's lots of influences. You can feel the 60s in it. You can feel the 40s in it. What we've done is we've designed, because it's so much about time, and they refer to time, and the clock chimes every now and then, and you can feel time slipping, is that we've played with the slippage. So Hilda Mack is remembering her husband being up there 40 years ago, hoping he'll come back. He's suddenly found in the end of Act One. The young lovers, of course, are looking forward to a future which they never have. They then end up on the mountainside and they talk about the future that they never had, as though they were looking back on it. So this sort of slide rule of time we've played with the design, where some characters are wearing clothes that go back through the century while some are going forward. So actually we cross the design. Yeah. So we keep it as a theatrical 1910, which is both nominally 1910 in a hotel, but actually the people start in the 60s, some of them, and go back towards 1910. Mm. Some go forward, like Hilda Mack. So it's
The poet does something pretty unspeakable, which we won't give away, towards the end of the piece. And I wondered again whether Auden was kind of, you know, that it seemed almost like a confessional that someone should do something like this for their own, again, creative gratification in order to be able to end the poem successfully.
I think so. I mean, we've tried to really... It's hard to do a piece about a writer because writing is such a private and minimalist, untheatrical activity. But I think he does try a lot. He's looking for Edelweiss, and he sends these two young people up to the mountain to try and get some Edelweiss, which he says is an imaginary prompt for him. But also, he plays games a lot with his secretary, and I've put in more of these games so that he's always looking... So we know that there's somebody always looking for inspiration. And then he does or doesn't. He doesn't help at a moment when he could help, which allows some catastrophe to occur. And I think a lot of creative people live in that place where they're not interested in the news, they're not interested in who's going to be elected. They're interested in how they're going to get the thing on stage or fixed or what they're painting or painters. I mean, I think people have ruined marriages and muses. His girlfriend is a muse, Elizabeth is a muse. And people are willing to... When you're a muse, you have the whole focus of the artist's attention. When you're not the muse, you're no longer the muse. You really no longer matter. And I think that sort of thing Auden is really pointing up.
The Auden, each act and each scene has been given a title by the librettist. Is that something that's useful from a directorial point of view, or are you tending to ignore this?
I'm trying to ignore it because I think it's more a poetic thing. I think it's useful, you know, useful for those who are used for. Usually there's a phrase from a little section, so they're like mini scenes, but very often there's a question asked at the end of one scene and answered at the beginning of the next scene. So there's no great chance, except that we are thinking that we will allow these chimes that often happen on these to really shift the perspective of the audience. So even though you're in the middle of a conversation, the perspective may change. Mm. It's complex. It's great fun.
Yeah, I mean, just listening to it, I mean, there's only one recording, which unfortunately is in German, and it's only excerpts from it. But looking at it, I mean, some of it is spoken, some of it is sung, some of it's very elaborately sung. It's kind of a mixture of things, part play, part opera.
Well, I hoped it was going to be a play. I mean, I said, and Hensa said to me, when I'm doing the play, and I said, you call it a play? He said, I do, yes. In fact, we have a wonderful conductor, a really wonderful man called Stefan Blumier, and he's very keen that the language stay pretty strictly within. Now, I have seen fragments of it on the internet, of versions where people have been incredibly free with it, but I think I'm going to apply a pretty rigorous beat to the evening. It's long enough as it is. I don't feel that we should necessarily go off-piste. So, in fact, it's less of a play than I would like in some respects, but we're also finding that if they keep the intention of the thought but the rhythm of the language as written within the frame, we make it sound quite like a play.
What's you talked about being a kind of a zen-like presence in the rehearsal room. I mean, what's it like in the Fiona Shaw rehearsal room? I mean, do you try to create the environment that you would like to work in as an
yes.
actor?
I mean, I do two things. One thing is we play ball games for a good 20 minutes beforehand, so we've got obsessed with this ball game, really stupid game where we kind of hit a ball and then you have to use different limbs of your body, and we all play that. And I think then everyone is in the same state of play. I think that's really important. The second thing I really wanted to make happen, and I'm incredibly proud of them, is I didn't want to direct, inverted commas, as a sort of active transitive action. I hate being directed. I think my job is to allow the singers to respond to the text, and such a good text in this case, to bring a bit of themselves out. So a lot of what they do is their ideas. I mean, I've had also a lot of ideas, and I suggest them. But if they don't like them, I want their ideas. So I hope the audience are going to enjoy seeing very much Stephen Page and Smittenhofer, you know, and sometimes there's questions arising, we haven't quite solved them. So that their personalities inform what they're playing, because I do believe that the theatre is at its best when the performer owns their performance. Yeah. Now, that's not entirely true if you've got a sort of genius like Richard Jones, who maps a world onto an opera with almost a meta-text that goes on top of the text.
It's
but
extraordinary.
In this instance, we're trying to bring out the text that people don't know. So each of these players is bringing... Lucy Schaefer brings absolutely that sort of sassy, bright American clarity to it. Kate Valentine, whose voice has blossomed into something quite breathtaking, is not just a soprano, but is a sort of huge soul of a person flowering. She's just phenomenal. And they're all marvellous. I mean, they all bring themselves to it. And, you know, we've got Jennifer Rhys-Davies, who's got this phenomenal voice, and who, and I'm hoping that we'll really enjoy seeing them being a bit bonkers, and they're neurotic, and they've all embraced that very well.
Mm. This is the working with singers, obviously, the business of singing has to be factored in, or does it?
Hugely. Stefan says this is the most difficult thing he's ever conducted. The singers all say it's the most difficult thing they've ever learned. On top of that, we don't have the conductor where we normally have the conductor. He's not in a pit. We have him and the whole band on stage. So the audience are going to have an exciting event of seeing the opera and also the band, which is huge, up high, also taking up half the stage. In fact, there's hardly any room for the audience. They're kind of squashed in around the edges. And I think it's an absolutely nightmarish situation because the conductor isn't facing them. So we're using monitors, and they've also got performances that are incredibly tricky where they're moving around all the time. So it's almost in the round. So they have to be incredibly fluent, incredibly dexterous, incredibly real, and yet take these weird beats because for some reason Henson has often moved the bar one note across, so the four is on the first beat of the next bar. Incredibly hard for them.
Music's obviously very important for you in your life. I get the feeling this is only your second opera, but are you hooked? I mean, do you see yourself? Do you want to direct more opera?
Have
you got any
yes.
things in mind that you'd love to do?
Oh, I would love to do the Dialogue of the Carmelites.
Ah, yes.
I would love to do that. I'd love to get better. This is very much, a practice piece. I'm very privileged to be allowed to do something that is one of the great 20th century pieces, I think, or in part will be. I think some of it is absolutely.
I think it's one of his best pieces.
And
frankly, I think it got very bloated later on. I think it became more and more post-Wagnerian. And,
yeah. Though he didn't like Wagner, or so he says. But actually, he said, "I'm not influenced by it at all." He went to Wagner, said, "It's quite interesting, but no influence on me." But of course, the subconscious influence of Wagner is just huge on that extended line. There's a scene on a mountain in Act 3, which goes on for a long, long time and is achingly slow, but if we're emotionally correct with it, it should hold beautifully. Complete Wagner. Completely.
Yes, no, but I don't buy that at all.
I would love to do... I didn't want to dip my toe into the 19th century until I felt that I could learn something, and I feel that, at least with 20th century operas, I'm not trying to... I'm not trying to face the giants who have done the great productions of earlier work, so I'm just practising.
And it occurred to me, looking at the libretto for this, which is, really good, I would love to have had Britain's Death in Venice. I mean, Alan Bennett's conjecture about Auden wanting so desperately to write the libretto for that piece in Habit of Art I think he could have stripped away all that kind of sexual inhibition that changed the way Britain wrote the piece. I mean, I still think it's a masterpiece, but
I do, and I think was it Mathanwy who did
yes,
that one? But at least she had a fantastic lack of ego in her writing. Didn't
yeah.
she really served, and I think the Charles Screw is absolutely brilliantly done. But I think Auden actually mightn't have been the easiest librettist in this instance with Elegy for Young Lovers, as you may know, that he. Henson said when it arrived, he initially wrote a rather silly opera, Auden, And I think he probably just was joking about the whole notion of what an opera might be. And Henze went back and said, I want something psychological. So sure enough, they did piece the psychological drama together, and some of it is still difficult to unpick, actually. It's quite brilliantly done. And I think Henze was so in love with the idea that Ordner actually had done it that he's been incredibly true to him. I'm not sure you wouldn't need to wrap Auden on the knuckles every now and then and say, fewer words, say this less.
Yes.
But we could found it very hard to cut, but we've tried to, little bits because it is very long, but actually it's incredibly tightly written, the poetry of it and the music to match the poetry of it. So Henze has been very true to Auden, and Auden has been incredibly true to himself by writing this very, very interwoven, connected, not fragmentary piece. But it's got far too many words for an opera, really.
Mm. Well, I'm going to let you have your little downtime, rest time now before the next show. Is it tough actually?
Not having any rest time.
Mixing the moving from the role of director into a performance. I mean, how jarring is that?
It's like swimming and then playing tennis. I'm not sure. Maybe
there you go.
It's a sort of daily triathlon, isn't it? Or something. It's very nice. It's very good fun.